Benedict has spoken extensively in the past about religious freedom, significantly in 2008 when he visited the United Nations. What do you think is the novelty, the most significant feature of this particular message?
I think the novelty or the newness that this message brings is probably the context, and it's probably, you know, when and at the time it's taking place. Naturally, when he visited the UN, it was basically to do with what the UN as an institution stood for, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And he referred to that as the United Nations having given a language, you know, to all nations, I mean, an ethical structure for all nations, you know, to go by and to walk by. This time, we're just taking one of those human rights, you know, declared by the United Nations, which is, you know, Article 18, I think. And that's more about, you know, the freedom, religion, what we refer to as the religious freedom. And it has come up this day because in the light of so very many things happening. For example, the issue of secularism has rendered every talk about God and religion less tolerant, okay, and still worse with anything about religious practice, religious expression. All of that is increasingly being pushed into like some private domain and nothing for the public arena or public place. And the big point, though, unfortunately, is that without religious freedom and what it stands for, this respect for the dignity of the individual and how, you know, it gives expression to this dignity in seeking after truth, in seeking after God, and manifesting this in terms of, you know, human relationship and all of that. If we were to circle that out of human existence, then the world would be poorer, you know, for that. The second factor which we may talk about is also the incidence of religious pluralism or plurality of religious expressions, which also comes with a thing about, you know, it's slightly intolerant forms, you know, one form of expression not being able to cope with the other form of expression in a world which is increasingly making an experience of this, you know, plurality of religious expressions. Globalization is enhancing that, and the increased mobility, or even of people, is just bringing people together who have never been together before, and exposing people to expressions of culture and, you know, religion which they've not been used to before. So instead of this, opening up people to dialogue and to enrich themselves with each other's experience, and seeing how together they can probably marshal the force of religion to do something good for humanity and all of that, that is not happening. Rather, it's been the tendency of exclusivism, each one shutting each one out and stuff like that. And that, again, is leading to some forms of, you know, intolerant conduct and behavior, sometimes even degenerating into really fundamentalistic positions, you know, persecution of other religious groups and all.
It's very striking how the Pope condemns religious fundamentalism, but also, as you mentioned, this secular fundamentalism. He says one is as serious as the other.
It is, and probably while it's easy even sometimes to identify religious fundamentalism because you can see where it's coming from its traits. Secular fundamentalism is more difficult to deal with. It's more difficult because it becomes, as it were, a pervasive culture in which people live. And then that gets expressed also in its forms of governance, okay, so that imperceptibly you have governments assuming and adopting certain positions which are not too friendly, you know, to the human spirit and human growth.
And yet many would say that people are dying from religious fundamentalism. They're not dying from this secular fundamentalism.
Oh, yes. When they say people are dying for religious fundamentalism, it's like they can see incidents of murder, incidents of attack, and so that can be seen. But what is subtle to see is how other people die, because, for example, there are places already where doctors, you know, have difficulty getting permission to practice if they're not ready, okay, to do certain procedures, if even that is against their own religious convictions, okay. Now, in that case, you shut out somebody from the exercise of a profession he studied all his life for, and then, what, you condemn him to a certain form of living, which is far lower than whatever. That's a certain form of, you know, killing, diminishing people's lifestyle, which don't make the headlines as, you know, an attack like in Iraq, a group enters a church and massacres or brutal. But secular fundamental is also diminishing the lifestyle and the quality of life for so very many other people. If people need to, you know, be free and express themselves and aspiring after those type of things which respond to their innate nature and character and are afraid to do this in public or feel embarrassed to do this in public, then you having people living, as it were, in a like, you know, psychotic type of lives or not. All there are very subtle psychological forms of expression which we need to recognize when we talk about, you know, secular fundamentalism or the secular culture forcing people to adopt certain modes of forms. In that case, sometimes this gets expressed as some states describing themselves as religious states, declaring themselves as, you know, whatever. If, for example, if it were ever possible to say, the Catholic Republic of Ghana, for example, then it will mean right away that you kind of identify as citizens only those who are Catholic. And if you would happen to have non-Catholics there, they will be citizens of second class. That's what happens when we, with all these state religions. Okay, and there are a few of them, a few of them also around. That's a subtle form of persecution.
This message is directed to all people of goodwill, but definitely, it is a direct challenge, isn't it, to governments and to legislators?
It is. You know, you look at the title religious, you know, freedom, and the tendency is to think that this is only about, you know, faith, religion, and groups like that. But if religious freedom is recognized as a response to basic expression of a personal dignity of individuals, then, you know, it's not something that refers only to those who kneel in churches and pray. Then we're talking about something that responds to the basic intrinsic expression of the human spirit, okay? And ultimately is the capacity, it is the longing of the human spirit for what is basically true about itself, about its relationship with other people, ultimately about relationship with God, okay? All of that belongs to religious freedom. This capacity to give expression to this intrinsic longing, it's almost like listening to St. Augustine say that there's no stronger desire within the human spirit than the desire for the truth. You know, if that is the case, then you don't need to put God there for people to recognize that they're dealing with God, but they would do something that is within every person.
The transcendental
aspect, that's within every person. And if we label the transcendental truth, it's because we go on from there to recognize that this is rooted in the fact of our creation by God. Okay, so the basic character of our being is that we're created by God. And that relationship is what gets expressed in terms of, in religious terms. But we are basically dealing with this basic innate longing within the human soul. This is very positive because it leads to the construction, the build-up of, you know, decent social order, which promotes the advancement and the search for the common good, which ultimately makes for the peace of humanity. That's what this message is all about.
The message also defends the right or upholds the right of people to change their religion, or indeed not to hold any religious belief at all. This is a particular challenge, isn't it, to the Islamic regimes which see this as leaving your Muslim faith as a kind of treason.
This is a very, you know, subtle aspect of this subject matter. You know, when we talk about religious freedom, we recognize, of course, that the UN came up with this. And in the UN, in Article 18 of the UN, you know, Declaration of, you know, Universal Declaration, freedom of religion is freedom, you know, of conscience, to believe, to change, whatever. All of those are involved. When, however, within the Catholic Church, we talk about religious freedom, we're talking not so much about the freedom to choose between one A and B, one religion from another, between whatever. That's not the first and primary sense of religious freedom when we talk about this in the church. In the church, religious freedom is first and foremost what I just said, that this basic innate and capacity, longing of a man, of a person to seek for the truth, to long for the truth, to find the truth and all. That for us is the basic sense of religious freedom. And when that is the case, the truth is one. And so it doesn't ultimately become a choice between A and B. So true religious freedom, which is aspiration after the truth, the absolute truth, it's not a question of choice between A and B because they are equally good.
And yet this message talks specifically about the right of someone to change from one religion to the other.
Yes, to the extent that one can change from a lower appreciation of truth to a higher appreciation of truth. Not all truth, if you want, is saving. If, for example, you take the Christian gospel and the missionary charge, okay, go preach the gospel to all people, whatever. If you take the version of Mark, for example, he goes on to say, and who believe, you know, and are baptized will be saved. Then there is the aspect of salvation. Okay, so then it's like the proclamation of the gospel, the missionary church, is to offer people a truth which saves. Now, not all truth saves. Not every form of truth leads to salvation. That's why ultimately religious freedom is not a choice between A and B. It's a choice actually for that truth which saves, that truth which ultimately leads to the full experience of peace and contentment and happiness of the human person. And every form of truth is not like this. So, yes, we know the United Nations Declaration talked about truth as a freedom to choose whatever type of sin. We recognize that. And we want to root this in anthropology, if you want, in the basic character of the human person, and direct it towards the ultimate goal of what every longing for the truth is, which is ultimately for the absolute truth for God. So that would be the small difference. That's how the Catholic social teaching on religious truth, if you want, perfects, if we may use that expression, the formulation of this in the UN Declaration.
The message also underlines the importance of dialogue with other religions about this issue, doesn't it? It's a subject very close to your own heart too, isn't it?
Very close. It is just that the message recognizes that the different pursuits of truth can bring us all to bring together our resources, inspiration, and ideas for and work for the common good. That is possible. So the dialogue situations are, you know, just recognize our, you know, various approaches to this truth would enable us to develop positive, you know, elements and traits which can be brought together for the advancement of the common good. In that sense, the different pursuits or the different initiatives of dialogue within the church, you know, whether it's that with, you know, non-Christian religions or even with, you know, other Christian religions, all of that have this as an objective. And I may refer to a particular example. As you probably know, there is a Cardinal Lucier Foundation, which does an ongoing dialogue and meeting with Jews in New York almost every year. I have participated in that, you know, two or three times. And I refer to it because at the last meeting when we were talking about it, one of the rabbis, they made it absolutely clear what for them this dialogue is all about and leading to. And it wasn't a question of discussing, coming together to discuss whose view or perception of God is true, whose will know. It's just that from our different, you know, religious experiences, we can come together to address certain common issues which diminish our lives here as Christian, whatever. So, you know, be the issue of the environment or whatever type of. So it's like coming together as a religious group to address certain common issues.
So in fact, interfaith dialogue should be focused much more on cooperation on these common concerns rather than real theological dialogue about the faith.
It is not this or that. Sometimes clarifying certain theological issues open the way wider to be able to bring together these resources to do what we need to do, okay? Sometimes skewed perceptions of one's whatever sometimes keep us apart. So sometimes a discussion of that also comes in, okay, to see how far sometimes we're not so far apart after all. But it's the way we've perceived. And our prejudices are there and they exist. And they sometimes keep us apart. So sometimes some clarification of issues are necessary to bring us more close together and help us, you know, bring our resources, you know, together to do what we need to do.
This Peace Day message, the theme is announced back in July, so it's obviously been in the works for many, many months. Mm. And yet it opens with this very striking example of the brutal attack on the Church of Our Lady of Salvation in Baghdad. Mm. It's particularly timely in this sense, isn't it?
That's why, you know, in response to your first question about what is special about this, but I refer to the context. What happened in Iraq is, as it were, you know, just pushed strongly to the forefront just the very many other similar manifestations and instances that, you know, we've been witnessing in around the world. This one in Iraq was people entering the church to do what they did. But elsewhere, we've had people, you know, you heard of cases in Nigeria sometimes. You had cases in southern Sudan, the clash between them, the ongoing fight and battle. You know, there are different cases, like, you know, the case in the Balkans, okay? Different religious clashes have always been there. And that comes to the general background. But that of Iraq is, as it were, holds up the thing and say, look, that's the naked face of this religious intolerance and how it can lead us to be real murderers and give rein to the worst sentiments within us.
Yeah. What do you hope this message can do in this, as you say, very dramatic context?
You know, although as I observed, that the church's understanding of religious freedom is not just limited to a UN formulation, but it's good to have the UN formulation also in view. And it is basically to say that, look, all of you nations, you did ratify this years ago. So in a way, we're not coming with something that is completely new. It's almost like in the letter of Elijah, it is new yet it's not new. It's new in the way it is being said and when it's being said, but you did ratify this very many years ago. And so, you know, it's something that if you've been true to what your heads of state and all of that ratified, then this is something that you should be respecting all along. Okay, now, failure to respect it is what is occasioned this reminder. Okay, so in that sense then, this message can be seen as a reminder of something which nations have already subscribed to, committed themselves to, you know, since 1948. Is it a lapse of memory, or what is it that has made people treat this as if it's not, you know? So a certain amount of commitment to the type of things that we go to these international conferences to debate, to dog, and then append our signatures. It is true that the UN declarations have a different character. They're not immediately binding, and they require the different, you know, conventions to make them binding. And it is, you know, people signing of the conventions which make them really subtractive. But again, following the declaration, there's been several conventions and nations have signed. So there are nations which have committed themselves to this. And in that sense, this nation, addressed to all men of goodwill, is reminding them of this commitment. And so inviting them to apply themselves to respecting, you know, the terms of this commitment. As a church, however, in addressing this, over and above the reminder, we want to add the fact that it is not just a reminder, you know, of people stepping or coming out of a war, the Second World War, but it's also the way of ensuring peace. Okay, that's why for us, the thing about religious freedom being an expression of what is intrinsic within man's desire for the thing, basically inspires the very many efforts and the very many initiatives that one undertakes under this impulse and inspiration to improve upon his world, to do, you know, good things. For example, all these hospitals and schools which missionaries have developed, you know, in mission countries, it's been under such inspiration. Even here in Europe, the four big figures, you know, underlying the formulation of the European Union, were all people of faith, okay? And you look at what religion or Christian has done to this culture, or the culture of this nation. So we, over and above that, you know, about respecting some promises or commitments made, we draw our attention also to what this manifestation of the human spirit can also bring to human advancement, growth, and what may we call peace. So all of that is, you know, what we're coming up with.